I will go ahead and get started on today's training class. In your confirmation email, there was a training website. If you have not already, please go to that website. Select Go to Training. And after you enter your name, you'll be on slide one training class. And again, we are still picking up background noise. So if you just had your phone ring, that it means that we are picking up background noise from your location. So please be sure that your phone is on mute. And again, star 6 to mute the phone using our system. On slide 1, I'd like to welcome everyone. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, an overview of direct push well technology for long-term groundwater monitoring. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Sampling Characterization and Monitoring Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Warrensburg, Missouri today. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's training. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Sampling Characterization and Monitoring Team. As we go through the presentation, each of you in the audience are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner of the slides, and our instructors are going to say that as we go through the slides. If you're using the Clue-In system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate. Most often you'll use the third button, the single right arrow, to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The house button takes you back to that presentation overview page where we started today. The question mark button is there primarily for our simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is hearing today's training through their computer speakers instead of over a phone line. If you're in the simulcast audience and you have a question, you can select that question mark button, type in your question, and I'll receive that as a moderator, and we'll get to as many questions as we can during the question-answer breaks. Anyone is welcome to use that question mark button at any time during today's presentation to send in a question or a comment. For our phone line audience, I encourage you to ask your own questions out loud, but we do ask that you wait until the designated question-answer breaks. We're going to have one in the middle and another at the end of the presentation. As listed on this slide, today's training is based on the ITRC technical and regulatory guidance. The use of direct push well technology for long-term environmental monitoring and groundwater investigations. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to download the guidance document itself. In addition, the presentation is available to download. During today's training, you'll see information on the slides. In the downloaded version, we have additional information available in the speaker's notes section. Today's training is brought to you in cooperation with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They host the Clue-In website that we're using today. Today's course is going to provide a background and the principles of direct push wells and present state-of-the-art regarding recent research. If you move to slide 2, I'm going to talk very briefly about ITRC. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators, including regulators from all 50 states and D.C. Federal partners are Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. Members of industry participate in ITRC through the ITRC Industry Affiliates Program. We also include academia and community stakeholders on our team. ITRC addresses a very wide variety of topics and produces documents and training like today's internet-based training. For more information about ITRC, I've listed the website at the top of the slide. We'll also take you to the link at the end that will allow you to go to the website. ITRC is on its annual part in the where you can sign up for a team. So I encourage you to look at the ITRC website to see if there's a new topic that is of interest to you. On slide 3, this is our disclaimer and copyright. We include this information in all ITRC training presentations and ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says we tried to provide accurate and reliable information but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide 4, this is a list of the course topics that we've offered in 2008. We're working on our schedule for 2009 right now. And again, more information will be available soon on the ITRC website. On slide 5, again, the logistical reminders. It's very important for our phone line audience to keep your phone on mute. And again, star 6 to mute the line. In today's presentation, we're going to start with an overview, talk about advantages, limitations, and known regulatory barriers. We'll have a break for questions about halfway through, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until the designated question-answer breaks. In the second half, we're going to talk about data between direct push and conventional wells. We'll go through some case studies. We'll talk about health and safety and stakeholder and tribal concerns. At the end, we'll take you to some links to additional resources, and that does include a link to our feedback form. And so we do ask that everyone on the call today fill out that feedback form. Your feedback is very important to us, and we appreciate you taking a few minutes to fill out that feedback form. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All instructors are members of the ITRC Sampling Characterization and Monitoring Team. Keisha Long is an environmental engineer working for the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. She's a project manager in the State Superfund program. Her responsibilities include overseeing the assessment, remediation, and cleanup of Superfund sites in South Carolina, and overseeing the assessment and cleanup of voluntary cleanup program sites. Keisha is the team leader for the Sampling Characterization and Monitoring Team. Brad Call is a senior environmental engineer with the Sacramento District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He has also served as the innovative technology advocate for his district, charged with encouraging consideration of emerging characterization and remediation approaches. His district provides environmental restoration services to Department of Defense facilities in California, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona. Bill Major works for the Naval Facilities Engineering Service Center in Port Hueneme, California. He has over 25 years' experience developing innovative technical solutions for a wide variety of environmental problems. He is a project lead for the ESTCB-funded project titled Demonstration Validation of Long-Term Monitoring Using Wells Installed by Direct Push Technologies. If you move to slide 7, I'm now pleased to turn over today's presentation to Keisha Long of the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. Keisha?
All right. Thank you, Juliana. And I would like to thank everyone today for participating in today's training. And we should be on slide number 7 right now. First of all, what we will learn, the basics of direct push wells, what they are and how they are constructed. Also, we'll look at the materials used to build them and where they are used. And just for clarification, we'll be referring to direct push wells as DP wells throughout this presentation. Okay, we also will go through sampling considerations, including basics about purging techniques, advantages and disadvantages of DP wells, and known regulatory barriers to their widespread use for long-term monitoring. Chemical and hydrogeologic comparisons between DP wells and hollow-stem auger wells will be presented, and this presentation will also include an overview of federally and state-sponsored case studies. And the last thing we will look at will be stakeholder concerns. This training is based on an ITRC document that was created by the Sampling Characterization and Monitoring Team. The title of it is Direct Push Well Technology for Long-Term Environmental Monitoring and Groundwater. So you can download it at your leisure. Let's go to the next slide, number 8. Why monitoring wells? Well, monitoring wells are used to collect groundwater samples for determining the nature and extent of contamination in an aquifer. Data collected from wells are used in risk assessment calculations and are used to verify that remediation goals have been met. Different types of drill rigs include air rotary, mud rotary, hollow stem auger wells, sonic rigs, there are many sonic rigs, and others. State regulations vary. Section 3.3 of the document that this training is based on lists the web links to individual state regulations. So we've already done the research for you. All right, let's go to the next slide, number 9. What are DP wells? Well, they are installed using a static or steady force to push the DP rods into the ground. They also can be installed using a dynamic or a hammering action. DP wells are typically 2 inches or smaller in diameter. And DP wells historically have been used for short-term monitoring, or in other words, less than 1 year. These wells are also called temporary wells. Next slide, 10. So what's the big deal? Well, DP wells can be installed at least 2 times faster than conventionally drilled wells. Also, DP technology can be used to obtain continuous soil cores or discrete soil samples, groundwater samples, and vapor samples. A conductivity sensor probe can be used with DP rigs to map subsurface lithology. Basically, wells are an important part of the environmental field, and DP wells can help professionals assess and clean up sites faster. DP technology produces less IDW, and the reduced time spent on private property can lead to improved landowner relations. Unfortunately, there are regulatory barriers limiting DP installations for long-term use. So moving on to the next slide, 11. This is a map that was developed after researching the well regulations or guidance for each state. And the black represents states with the annular space barrier. And just a quick, simple definition of annular space is the space between the well casing and the wall of the drilled hole. The green striped states allow the installation of DP wells for long-term use. There are no known barriers in those states. And the sampling team was not able to determine whether a barrier existed for the states that are white or not colored in. State DP regulations fall into one of the following categories. Their use for long-term monitoring is prohibited. Their use is approved, or their use is approved with strings attached. And these strings often are time limits. For example, a regulation may restrict the use of a DP well to less than a year. Where no guidance exists, DP wells for long-term use are installed using variances or waivers. South Carolina, Ohio, and a handful of other states include references to DP wells for long-term use in the regulations, so we consider those to be states with no barriers. Just a side note, Indiana modified its well rule from a minimum annular size requirement to a performance-based standard. I believe they did this about a year and a half ago. Again, Section 3.3 of the document lists the web links to the individual state regulations. Okay, next slide, 12. The CPT, or cone penetrometer, is a heavy piece of equipment that can incorporate such sensor technology as the membrane interface probe, or MIP, and the GeoVis. CPT systems use a static reaction force to advance steel rods, a sampler, or analytical device into the ground. And the force used generally is equal to the weight of the truck. Now, a different type of DP well system is the dynamic force DP, which is often mounted on a pickup truck, a van, or a bobcat. A rotary hammer system using a force generated by the static weight of the vehicle on which it is mounted, and a percussion hammer to advance steel rods, etc., is used. This smaller rig can fit into tight spaces, and my personal experience has involved this type of rig. Okay, next slide. Performance of technology. I want to highlight just a few of the advantages and one of the disadvantages. The case studies that will be presented by Bill Major later on will highlight the fact that data from DP and hollow stem argon wells are comparable, and that is one of our advantages in the list. In-field observations have shown DP wells can be installed at a rate 2 to 5 times faster than hollow stem argon wells, and consequently this time savings leads to less expense for the installation and the eventual abandonment or necessary replacement of a well. As a disadvantage, DP wells for long-term use are not accepted in most states as indicated by the map on the previous slides. Let's move on to the next slide, 14. DP wells can be integrated into a comprehensive dynamic work strategy, such as the triad approach: systematic project planning, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement technologies are the three legs of the triad. And the triad document can be found at the ITRC website. The sampling team also developed this document, and there is internet training associated with this triad approach. It's in archives on the CLUIN site. Okay, let's move on. Next slide, number 15. These are pictures of the membrane interface probe in use in the field. And the first picture is showing the DP rig in the field with some of the operators. And the middle picture is showing the membrane itself, and that's the light-colored oval. And the bottom picture is the computer-generated image of the MIP results. And in this instance, this was in South Carolina Greer at a NPL Superfund site. And we were looking for VOCs, volatile organic compounds. And with the MIP, we found a source that was previously unknown to exist at the site. Okay, next slide, regulatory issues. Again, the primary regulatory issue concerning DP wells is that most states require a minimum annulus size for a monitoring well. And this requirement can't be met by the DP installation technique. Next slide. Regulatory concerns. State regulations often include that annular space requirement, and some regulators also have questions about the effective annular sealing of the well using the trimming method in particular. And there are also some questions about the filter pack and whether they are used or designed based on grain size distribution of the geologic formation. And until recently, there were no extensive scientific case studies evaluating the use of DP wells for long-term monitoring. However, let's go to the next slide, 18. This slide is listing various regulatory barriers in individual states. For example, Florida has a 2-inch annular space requirement. In Illinois, it does allow the installation of DP wells with pre-packed filters for up to a year or longer, providing the overall integrity of the well is demonstrated. And Oklahoma also has some restrictions. But in summary, wells are an essential part of the environmental field, and DP wells can help professionals assess and remediate sites faster. Regulatory barriers do exist that limit DP well installations for long-term use. Now we'll hand the presentation off to Brad Call. He's with the U.S. Corps of Engineers, Sacramento District, and he will give more detail on the materials used for DP wells, installation techniques, advantages, and disadvantages.
Well, thank you very much, Keisha.
All right.
Well, welcome, everybody, to the technology portion of the presentation. And we should all be on slide number 19. And this slide provides an overview of what I'll be discussing. And that's going to include how these DP wells are constructed, the importance of proper development, a few words on sampling. And then we'll spend a little time on a question that everyone pretty much has in their mind is, you know, how does the hydraulic conductivity affected by the direct push installation process? Then we'll go through those advantages and disadvantages that Keisha just introduced us to in a little bit more detail. And then finish up by a few concluding thoughts on how to determine if the application of direct push wells might be suitable for your particular site. Let's now move on to slide 20. And My purpose here is to try to establish a common frame of reference for the remaining part of the discussion. Now, of course, we all are accustomed to what I'm going to refer to as conventional well installation techniques. And those are normally performed with some sort of rotary drilling action. And that could be using a hollow stem auger or mud rotary or a number of other technologies. And once we've advanced our borehole, we then install that conventional well in a sequential fashion within the borehole. And that's going to include a well casing, screen, filter pack, grout seal, etc., etc. And often these monitoring wells constructed in this manner are either 2 inches or 4 inches in diameter. Now let's compare and contrast that with the subject of today's training, wells installed using direct push techniques. And just in short, that involves using a completely assembled well is inserted directly into the subsurface using direct push technologies. And in overall configuration, they're very similar to conventional wells. Let me just mention briefly that most of my presentation comes out of Section 2 of that companion technical regulatory guidance document that's already been referred to. All right, I'm now on slide number 21. There are two general installation techniques that we can consider. Both of these techniques are performed or can be performed with either the static or that dynamic direct push equipment that Keisha mentioned. And these two approaches are, number one is the protected screen technique, and number two would be the exposed screen technique. And when we're using the protected screen installation technique, the well casing is inserted down into the subsurface from inside the drive rod or the drive casing. When we're using the exposed screen technique, the well casing is actually to the exterior of the drive rod. So both methods are, of course, using steel drive rods and an expendable metal drive point. A question that often comes up is in regards to, well, just how deep can these direct push wells go? In my experience, most of the ones I've installed have been, you know, to a depth of approximately 30 feet below the ground surface. However, I have installed some up to a depth of over 80 feet. But I just want to mention that the maximum depth of installation is actually more of a site-specific condition rather than any inherent limitation of the technology. All right, let's now move on to slide 22, where we'll discuss that protected screen installation technique in a little bit more detail. And I should mention that this is the most commonly used technique. And so once again, the assembled well is placed down into the subsurface from inside that metal drive casing. Now, of course, by using this approach, that's going to protect that completed well from clogging and damage as we insert it. However, when we use this technique, that's going to require that we take some measures to ensure that we have an annular seal and filter pack. Now, the illustration on this slide shows a protected screen direct push well with a pre-packed filter, a grout barrier, which is referred to in this case as that foam bridge that's directly above the pre-pack. And then above that, we see a pre-packed grout seal, which is referred to as the bentonite slash quick seal sleeve. The left part of the illustration shows that completely assembled well inside the drive casing. To the right, we see the drive casing is being withdrawn and the completed well being left in place. All right, let's now move to slide 23 and just a few words on the exposed screen installation technique. So once again, in this case, the completed well is assembled around is outside of the drive rod. Now, as you can imagine, as we push that completed well down into the subsurface, we're exposing that well screen to damage and clogging. Now, I have used this method at a few sites and did indeed observe clogging into the well screen. But it was possible to correct that during the development process. Another consideration is that if we have contamination in the soil, in the intervening soil layers, that as we push that well down into the subsurface, we're obviously exposing the well to contamination. So for all of these reasons, development is extremely important for wells that are installed in this manner. But there are some important advantages that we should consider. The installation of wells in this fashion is faster, it's less expensive, and theoretically, no annular seal is required. But if we think back to Keisha's discussion a little bit earlier, she was talking to us about that requirement for an annular seal in many states. And if we happen to be doing work in one of those states, then that might preclude us from considering this particular installation technique. All right, I am now on slide 24. And let's talk a bit about the construction materials that we would use. And in short, the materials that we use to fabricate a direct push well are almost exactly similar to those that would be used for a conventional well. The direct push well is going to include all the things that we're already very familiar with. There'll be a casing, there'll be a screen, a grout seal. We'll normally use PVC well casings. Of course, PVC stands for polyvinyl chloride. And we'll use either schedule 40 or 80, depending on the strength requirements that we have. And of course, those casing sections will be assembled using either threaded or flush jointed connections. And the most common casing sizes for direct push wells are going to be 3/4 inch, 1 inch, or 2 inch. The screens are often also going to be PVC, although metal screens are also available. And the slot size, of course, will be based on the soil conditions and filter pack that we're using. During his part of the presentation, Bill Major is actually going to be discussing some very interesting new developments regarding slot size and filter selection. All right, let's finish up with construction materials on slide 25. So, just a few words about the filter. We'll often use what is referred to as a pre-pack, which is installed around the screen prior to insertion. Now, by using this method, that ensures that we have a very precise placement of that filter pack. The filter shows the pre-pack, which is the wire mesh around the white PVC casing. So the pre-pack filter is to the right. The purpose for having the filter, of course, is to increase the hydraulic conductivity and to minimize turbidity in our samples. The pre-pack screens are normally wrapped with a stainless steel, polyethylene, or nylon mesh to hold the appropriately sized sand material. And of course, filter packs are not used in all direct push well installations because, of course, we couldn't use one if we were choosing to apply the exposed screen installation method. Of course, above the filter pack lies the grout barrier. The purpose there is to prevent the overlying grout seal from penetrating down into the filter and clogging it up. For direct push wells, we're often going to be using either a plastic or foam collars. We see in the filter here that we're using a plastic grout barrier, and that's that dark gray plastic collar you see just to the left of the filter pack. And once again, grout barriers are not always used. And then, of course, above the grout barrier, we have the grout seal itself. Purpose here, of course, is to prevent any sort of vertical water movement along the casing. And the grout seal can be either a pre-pack or it can be trimmed in from above. The pre-pack grout seals are typically going to be some sort of a dry bentonite mixture that expands upon contact with water. And of course, the tremied grout seals will be a hydrated mixture of bentonite and cement. Well, let's move on now to slide 26. Now, as I mentioned before, we will definitely be performing well development as part of our direct push well installation. And, you know, whether we're performing or installing either a conventional or a direct push well, whenever we drill a boring, it's altering the hydraulic characteristics of the formation materials. And so well development is very important to ensure that we reestablish that good hydraulic connection between the well and the surrounding groundwater system. It's also important to ensure that we minimize turbidity in our samples and ensure that they're representative of that part of the aquifer. The photo on this slide shows the dramatic reduction in turbidity that can result during the development process. On slide 27, a little bit more about the specific development techniques. And the most common ones that are used for direct push well installations are going to be either over-pumping, which some people refer to as purging, a mechanical surging, or water jetting. When we're using over-pumping, of course, we're using a pump that we've lowered down within the well casing, and then we rapidly remove the accumulated water and sediment. Mechanical surging involves a surge block that is lowered down within the casing. It's moved up and down in a repeated fashion to dislodge fine-grained materials. And then the water jetting also involves a probe that's lowered down within the well casing to the screened interval, and we direct a stream of water onto the screen and into that formation beyond to dislodge the fine materials. The photo shows from top to bottom a 2-inch surge block. In the middle there is a 3/4-inch surge block, and then at the bottom that's a valve that's used to control the water during the surging process. In my experience, I've often used a combination of techniques during development, and probably most typically would be using both over-pumping and the mechanical surging. And then slide 28 actually shows the development process in action. This gentleman is using a peristaltic pump to remove accumulated fluids from within the well casing, and is storing it in that blue barrel for proper disposal later on. Okay, now let's move to slide 29. Talk a little bit about sampling. So I really want to emphasize that sampling of direct push wells can be performed in a number of ways, and it's probably going to be more governed by the technical and regulatory constraints at your specific site. The three commonly used methods for direct push wells, as for conventional wells, would be, number one, purge and sample. Number two would be low flow sampling. And number three would be something that's getting more and more attention these days, is the no purge sampling. All right, let's talk just a bit about purge and sample. I think most people are very familiar with this. It's thought of as the traditional approach, and it's still widely used. When we're using it, we're trying to remove from 3 to 5 well casing volumes of water. And while we're doing that, we're going to be monitoring, of course, some specific groundwater parameters like temperature, pH, ORP, specific conductivity, turbidity, et cetera, et cetera. And the goal during the parameter, monitoring that parameter variability, observe it to drop below 10% so that we've confirmed that the groundwater conditions have stabilized before we collect our sample. Generally, we're going to be purging using either a baler or a submersible pump operated at a relatively high flow rate. Now, when we're purging the well in this way, of course, we might cause turbidity and actually mobilize colloids. And there's also the possibility of inadvertently completely dewatering the well, which is a bad thing generally. When we get to the point where we're ready to sample, the sample itself is often collected with a baler or with that pump. Okay, well, let's now move on to low flow sampling using the low flow purging technique. Here we're going to be purging using a small submersible pump, like a bladder pump, operated at a low flow rate, generally between 0.1 to 1.0 liter per minute. Our goal is to try to minimize the physical disturbance within the well, and also to minimize the drawdown, which we're trying to keep less than 4 inches. We can be monitoring those very same groundwater parameters I mentioned earlier if we desire, and the sample is most often also collected using that low flow pump. And Then lastly, the no purge methods. Of course, we're not removing any water from within the well casing. Samples might be collected using passive diffusion bags or snap samplers or a number of other similar technologies. Passive diffusion bags are 3/4 inch in diameter or larger and can be used with 1-inch direct push wells or larger. Additional information on passive diffusion bags and other no purge methods can also be found at the ITRC website. All right, let's see. This concludes the discussion of well construction, the development, and sampling. Let's now move on to a question that is in most people's minds, and that's in regards to, you know, has the hydraulic conductivity been adversely affected, during the installation process when we're applying direct push? And we'll begin that on slide 30. To look into this question, the Navy commissioned a study, and they were interested in directly evaluating the comparability of hydraulic conductivity, which is very often abbreviated using the capital letter K, between conventional and direct push wells. This slide that we're looking at here shows the members of the study team, and they're from a diverse sector of our environmental cleanup business, University of Connecticut, Western Michigan State University. Also, we have the Navy represented here, the Naval Facilities Engineering Service Center, and GeoProbe. The test itself was conducted at the direct push test cell at Port Hueneme in California. Let's now go to slide 31. During the course of this study, 296 pneumatic slug tests were performed. The slug tests were compared to steady and unsteady state pumping tests that were performed to determine if the slug tests were producing representative results. A little more on the study area itself. The geology is in alluvial sediments, highly permeable medium to coarse grain sands and gravels, and the depth to water was about 5 to 7 feet below the ground surface. The screened intervals of all the wells were fully submerged. Okay, let's start looking at some of the results here on slide 32. And this is a summary of all the results that were obtained. Now we're looking at box and whisker plots. The mean of the data is shown using the solid red dot. The horizontal line is the median of the data. The middle 50% of the data is that box that surrounds the dot, and one standard deviation around the mean is represented by those whiskers. What's referred to as whiskers are the vertical lines that extend above and in some cases below the box. All right, there were 5 different well types included in the study. Let's briefly go through that. There's a 2-inch conventional well installed using a hollow stem auger, and then 4 direct push well types. The first being a 3/4 inch direct push well with an ASTM designed prepack. ASTM stands for the American Society for Testing and Materials. The next direct push well is also 3/4 inch, and it was using a vendor off-the-shelf prepack filter design. Next, there's another 3/4 inch direct push well with no prepack. So as you remember, that would mean that was installed using the exposed screen method and was just naturally developed there within the aquifer. And then the last direct push well is 2 inches, and that also had an ASTM design prepack. Now as we just scan across the figure here, we see that generally the direct push and conventional wells were producing similar results. The direct push wells have a slightly lower hydraulic conductivity at this particular site. And let's look into these results in just a little deeper on the following slide, number 33. Here are some of the most important conclusions from the study. They concluded that short-duration pneumatic slug tests were an effective method to determine hydraulic conductivity at the site. The mean hydraulic conductivity value was 0.015 centimeters per second, and they had good reproducibility of the results. Statistical differences were found between the conventional and the direct push wells. However, the magnitude of that difference was small. Overall, the measured hydraulic conductivity was deemed comparable. Now, they had some other interesting observations. They concluded that for the same screened interval, hydraulic conductivity was actually independent of pre-pack design, well radius, induced head, and test method. So it was thought that the local variation in the formation and care in the way in which the screen placement was conducted will have a greater influence on hydraulic conductivity than well type. The reference to this study is shown on the slide, and it can also be found in the companion ITRC document for this training. During his portion of the training, Bill Major will provide additional information on this study, as well as another involving somewhat lower permeability soils. All right, so that concludes my discussion of the hydraulic conductivity evaluation. Let's now get back to those advantages and disadvantages. Slide 34 was, Keisha introduced us to this a little bit earlier. So now let's go through each one of these in more detail. So moving on to slide 35. The first advantage is that, of course, when we're using direct push wells or using direct push technology in general, we're not producing any drill cuttings. And, of course, drill cuttings can be contaminated. They're something that have to be managed. Also, well development wastes are reduced when we're working with smaller wells, which we're often doing when we are applying direct push. So when we have reduced amount of cuttings and development waste, that's going to lower our overall disposal costs, as well as the exposure of our field crews to potentially contaminated materials. The next advantage on slide 36 is in regards to our ability to work faster. Now, we can install direct push wells faster because in almost every case, pushing is going to be faster than drilling. We're also using smaller, more maneuverable drill rigs. And another factor is that, keep in mind the largely pre-constructed nature of the direct push well. So everything happens a lot faster. In fact, the Naval Facilities Engineering Service Center has observed that installation rates that are from 2 to 5 times faster than when installing conventional wells, given the same general geologic conditions. So these benefits result in faster characterization with no loss in quality. Okay, the next advantage on slide 37 is that we're able to, work in a more efficient and smarter manner. Keisha also mentioned that direct push wells are an important part of investigations conducted using the triad approach. So triad, for those of you who are not familiar, is an EPA initiative to improve the quality, cost efficiency, and timeliness of environmental restoration. The central theme that drives triad is managing sources of uncertainty that can lead us to making bad environmental cleanup decisions. So the figure shows the three components of triad, and just briefly, one of those components is systematic planning, and that's all about getting clarity in what our goals are and the procedures that we will be applying before we get to the field. The second component is the use of dynamic work strategies, and that's preparing flexible work plans and procedures that are adaptable to the unfolding investigation and developing conceptual site model. Because while we're in the field, we don't want to leave any important uncertainties uninvestigated. And then the third component of triad is in regards to real-time measurement technologies. And that's all about tools that allow us to rapidly sample, analyze, and manage data. And direct push technologies fit into that third category like a glove. So direct push technologies help us to better address the largest source of data uncertainty, which is always going to be contaminant and geologic heterogeneity. Using direct push, we can achieve a higher density of data, be it through samples, through wells, etc. And by getting that higher density, that's always going to result in a better developed conceptual site model and ultimately more confidence in the decisions that we are going to be faced with making. So for more information on TRIDE, I encourage you to go to that same ITRC webpage and get a copy of the report shown at the bottom of the slide or contact one of us instructors. Let's move now to the next advantage on slide 38. We're going to end up with more representative data, as I was just mentioning, because direct push allows us to get more sample data for the same amount of money. And if we get higher density, our conceptual site model will be better, our results are more representative. And cost-effectively achieving higher sample density has the largest beneficial influence on the quality of the work that we do. A textbook example of this is the use of the membrane interface probe, which is often abbreviated as MIP, linked up with a particular direct push technology. That can give us a dramatic improvement in the quality of our conceptual site model and our decision quality. All right, let's now move to our next advantage on slide 39. We can reduce the adverse effects on property owners. And that is because in most cases, direct push rigs are smaller and lighter than conventional type drilling rigs. We're also generally operating faster. And should we have selected the use of a CPT rig, the rigs are often going to be much more quieter as well. So all of that is going to mean that we're going to be less intrusive to the site, less of an impact to landscaping and roads. There's also going to be reduced landowner and public exposure to noise and the physical hazards of drilling equipment, which, as we know, can be significant. So all of this should contribute to better relations with affected property owners if we're using direct push technology. And then the last advantage I want to talk about is going to be on slide 40, that we're going to be saving money. Given all the advantages discussed, it's really no surprise that direct push is going to be less expensive. On a unit cost basis, direct push wells are less expensive than comparable conventional wells. They're not only less expensive to install initially, but to replace if they become damaged or when it's time to abandon them. The Naval Facilities Engineering Service Center estimates that the cost savings range from about 23 to 65%. All right, well, let's start now going through the disadvantages, because there certainly are some disadvantages that we have to bear in mind. So we should all now be on slide 41. And of course, direct push technology is not suitable for all geologic conditions. When we're faced with cobbles or gravels, or consolidated materials like bedrock, or cemented soils, for example, caliche, or dense sands, we may find that direct push technology just won't work for us. Clean sands can be a possibility for direct push, but the depth of penetration you can achieve might be limited, so you would need to carefully think through your project-specific objectives before using direct push in those instances. Another disadvantage is shown on page 42, or slide 42. We have those regulatory restrictions that Keisha introduced us to, with the primary one being that minimum annulus requirement for wells in many states. Individual regulatory RPMs in some states have also expressed concerns regarding the quality of the seal that's possible to achieve. So one of the most important purposes of giving this training today is we're hoping to get people to take a second look at this technology and reconsider some of these restrictions. Moving to slide 43, another potential disadvantage here is in regards to the well diameter. Currently, direct push wells are limited to a maximum of 2 inches in diameter. Now, that may or may not be a limitation, depending on the specific objectives you have for a particular project. Because, you know, in most cases, most groundwater sampling requirements can be easily met with a 2-inch or smaller well. But there are a few things that are performed at specific sites that you do need a larger well. And just to give an example, some of the geophysical techniques that are occasionally applied have probes that require a well diameter of larger than 2 inches, often at least 4 inches in diameter. So that's something we need to keep in mind. Let's move to the next disadvantage on slide 44. And that's the potential for cross-contamination. So whenever we're advancing a boring into the subsurface, it introduces really the possibility of dragging contamination from an overlying layer down deeper. Of course, that potential exists whether we're using both a direct push or a conventional drilling technique. Direct push borings do not include an outer casing or drilling mud, which is a component of some conventional drilling techniques that specifically reduce the possibility for cross-contamination. Another thing to keep in mind is that direct push wells installed using that exposed screen technique don't have an annular seal. So these concerns speak to the importance of really, thinking through the hydrogeology that you have at your particular site and carefully planning the well installation and really consciously understanding the sort of installation technique that will be appropriate for your particular site. Okay, and then the last disadvantage that I wanted to spend some time with here is the potential for higher turbidity on slide 45. So direct push wells installed using that exposed screen method, where we don't have a filter pack, may result in higher turbidity. And this is especially true if we haven't, properly conducted our development. The potential, of course, will be highest in fine-grained materials when we have clays and silts. Now, when we've used the protected screen installation technique that does include a filter pack, there won't be that potential for the higher turbidity. All right, we've gone through the advantages and disadvantages, and I thought we would just finish up this portion of the training by just thinking through whether or not some things to be considering to determine if direct push well technology could be suitable for your particular site. And let's do that on slide 46. So I would always begin by, evaluating the particular regulatory requirements and restrictions that are appropriate for the location or state that I'm at. So is there an annular space requirement in that state? If there is, then that might complicate the use of direct push technology unless it's possible to get a variance. And in many cases, it is possible to get a variance, so I encourage everyone to keep that in mind and to pursue that if you think that direct push wells could be a good candidate for a particular project. But once you're past that hurdle, once you've established that there are no regulatory restrictions, the next step is to consider two key technical questions. And the first is that, is the site geology suitable? Or in other words, might you be faced with gravels or consolidated materials, or bedrock? The second key question, do the data collection strategy that you've developed require that you need to have a well that's larger than 2 inches in diameter? If the answer to those questions is no, then you can consider direct push wells for your particular site, and I encourage you to do so. All right, well, that concludes the technology overview portion of the presentation, and I'm now going to turn it back over to Juliana for a question and answer period.
Thank you very much. We do now have time to take questions from our audience. For our simulcast participants, you can send in questions using that orange question mark button at the top of the page. For our phone line participants, I encourage you to ask your own questions out loud. Please state your name and location when you're asking your questions. Remember to unmute your phone. If you've used our system, it's *7. to unmute your phone so you can ask questions. I'll point out that along the left-hand side is a list of slide numbers in the clue-in page, and you're welcome to jump back to different slides if we refer to one of those. Do we have a question to start from our phone line audience?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes, and you are?
I'm Jerry Hemel with URS in New Orleans.
Yes.
I've used these direct push wells at a number of locations, kind of as temporary groundwater sampling points. Work quite well. The larger diameter pre-packs, I feel, are superior, give a much less turbid sample. But one of the things that we run into is when we go to take these out, because they're so small, they don't yank out very easily. They break apart, and we've even resorted to putting some caps on the bottom with some loops so we can fetch and kind of catch the wells out. But I was just wondering if anybody ran into that and if they worked out a better solution to yank these wells out.
I'll fill that one. This is Bill Major with NFESC. And what we've done, first we try to grab onto the top of the well, and imagine that's what you're talking about is to grab on the top of the well and try to pull out, but the well can come apart, right?
Right, but we've resorted to fishing a tool down the well and catching the bottom of the well and yanking it out, but that's kind of a hit or miss.
Right, and what we've done is we've developed this thing called the gripper, and if you can just imagine a steel cylinder with a bunch of knurls in it that is pretty close to the just undersize on the inner diameter of the PVC pipe, and we drop that down to the bottom, and it's held there by a wire rope, and then we throw some sand in, and then it catches on the very bottom, and then we just pull the well out from the bottom that way.
And how deep were the wells that you had success with this?
We've done it to 35 feet, and we may, I'm trying to remember what this other person did. It may have been as deep as 50, but no deeper than 50, but 35 for sure.
Is this something you made yourself, or is it available somewhere, or?
The Navy licensed it out to two companies, and I can get the name of those companies. This was quite a while ago we did that, so there should be two companies making it right now.
If you could get me that information, I'd very much appreciate that.
Uh-huh, yeah, not a problem.
And to follow up, on slide 6, we have Bill Major's email address. So if you just email him directly, that's the best way for you to follow up there on that.
That sounds great.
Thank you.
Oh, you can also over-drill them. That, I don't have one of those grippers, so we often just over-drill them out.
That kind of takes some of the advantage away with cuttings and stuff, and you get these wire pre-pack screens, and then you start getting tangled up in the augers and stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
But I like the idea of gripper, and I'll send Bill an email.
Yeah, sounds great.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
From Nam Bach at GSHI in Dallas, Texas, why is minimum annulus size important in most states?
I'll go for that one again. It's a legacy regulation that came out. These ASTM standards were designed for what was around at the time, which is the drill, putting in the drilled wells. And there's a guy named Driscoll that actually did some scientific work that showed that you really only need 2 or 3 grain size to actually filter properly. But the problem is that in the real world of putting something in, something can end up on the side of a hole or whatever, and so the annular space came out of that need to make sure that you had at least a couple grain size around there, and that's why that large annular space exists. And so those ASTM standards got into all the state regulations, and now fast forward here, we have direct push technologies with the filter packs and all, and where we can actually control the size with the pre-packs, we can control that grain size. And so the regulations should not be in our mind here, they should not be on the books anymore, and that was what a large part of this project was about, was just to educate everybody about the direct push wells can actually meet these original ASTM standards. But that doesn't stop the regulations from being on the books right now.
From Kelly Marshall at Booz Allen Hamilton in San Antonio, is the quality of the seal a potential disadvantage based on past failures?
Well, I don't know. My experience is that I have not had personally any failures. And I think that most of the regulatory concern on that particular issue is probably associated with older installations that were where they were using the exposed screen technique. When applying the protected screen installation technique, obviously we have a precisely placed prepack seal, and so there's less of a concern in that instance. Bill, have you personally, or Keisha, have you had any instances where you've had failures?
Not, this is Keisha, not failures per se, but I've seen contractors try to trim me with the DP wells, and it's, I mean, it's possible, but it's not easy. So while you're doing it, you kind of have a doubt in your mind as to whether it's getting to where you want it to be.
Good point.
So I think that's, I think part of my presentation touched on that, and I think that's really the question in the regulator's mind. Is this sand getting to where you want it to be in the hole?
If you choose to use the tremie
exactly.
method.
Yeah, probably best off to use the bentonite seals and the or the other one that you showed, Brad, the plastic kind of foldable seal.
Yeah.
Do we have questions from our phone line participants? A question from Brett Putman at the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation in Albany, and this is for Brad. How does drilling mud minimize cross-contamination? Are downhole ejector pumps available for 2-inch diameter wells?
Well, that's a that's a good question. You know, Bill, I'm not a geologist. I'm an engineer, and so I hate to say anything that's going to, lead you astray, but the process of using the direct push, has the potential to drag contamination down with it, and when using a conventional drilling technology, for example, the mud rotary. That is stabilizing the borehole, and we're drilling down within that, and so we're minimizing the opportunity for physically dragging something down because we're using a drilling action, and then the cuttings are being swept up, of course, into that drilling mud, and that is, of course, being brought up to the surface, and you're getting the cuttings out, and we're using the mud. So, my purpose in mentioning that is primarily focused on the physical aspect of, dragging soil, potentially contaminated soil, along the drive casing itself downward during the installation process when you're using direct push. Bill or Keisha, do you have anything to add on that topic?
For my aspect, I would say we'd have to get an email back to them on that and talk to some of the guys that are the actual installers.
Yes, I think that's a good approach.
I have marked that one for further follow-up. Thank you. From Kelly Marshall at Booz Allen Hamilton in San Antonio, what steps are involved in pneumatic slug testing?
Well, for those of you who are not familiar, the pneumatic slug test involves you attach a specific device to the top of the well casing, and you are either injecting air or you're removing air in a controlled fashion, and you're monitoring the impact on the groundwater elevation within the well, and then you're inferring the properties of the hydrogeologic properties of the aquifer based upon the reaction of the water to the different stress that's being put on it by the addition or withdrawal of water, or of air, excuse me.
And specifically the rate of that change.
Yes. And it's much easier to do those tests, obviously, than the pumping test, where you've got to manage all of the water that you remove. And so that's why the pneumatic slug tests are preferable if they will work properly. And for the particular test that we were discussing earlier today, there was the desire to use the pneumatic slug test, but they went to the extra mile to actually do the pumping tests as a quality control measure to ensure that they were producing accurate results.
Do we have questions from our phone line audience? From Robert Martin at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection in Jacksonville, the metal drive point could cause metals to leach out, and this would limit its use in long-term well also.
Yeah, I know that Louise Parker actually has a couple projects with Corel, has a couple projects on actually measuring what that leaching is, and so there's always talk in the DP world of other materials used, especially in cases where you're trying to measure an inorganic that might interfere with. But that's kind of an ongoing discussion.
And I suppose if that was a key investigative goal, were those particular inorganics that could be influenced by that, then I think something could be done to either use a different material for the drive point or to perhaps coat it in some manner to at least delay the rusting process.
From Bill Robinson at the Idaho Department of Environmental Management in Indianapolis, how can you directly confirm the adequacy of foam and bentonite seals?
Yeah, that's very difficult. There was actually somebody, the way you would do this, and it was actually done one time that I know of, was a clear pipe instead of the PVC pipe was put down, and then some dyed water was actually flooded around a DP well on the top of a drilled well, and a camera was lowered down to see leaking down and see which well was sealing better than the other. In this particular test, the DP well was actually sealing better. But this was by no stretch a comprehensive study of that particular. But that's one of the best ways that I've heard of doing that.
Thank you. We do have more simulcast questions, but reading over them, I know that Bill addresses some of these issues in the second half, so I'm going to go ahead and hold those questions. And let's go ahead and continue with the second half of our training. We plan to have more time at the end of the presentation for questions from our audience. For the second half of the training, please move to slide 48. If you have taken your phone off mute, and really it's a great chance for everybody to double check to be sure your phone is on mute. And as a reminder, it's *6 to mute your line using our system, and I'll remind you at the next question answer break how to unmute. On slide 48, I'll now turn our presentation over to Bill Major of the Naval Facilities Engineering Service Center. Bill.
All right. Thank you, Juliana. Today I will be talking about two separate but what I think are very complementary case studies. One was funded by the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, and that is ESTCP, and this is the one that I've been involved with the last several years. And then there's another study that was done by British Petroleum and EPA Region 4 and 5, and both these studies are side-by-side comparisons of direct-push wells and hollow-stem auger installed wells. And then after the case studies, I also introduced some new technologies made possible by direct push wells that we and other research organizations are either developing or performing demonstration validations on. So first, I'd like to give a little bit of background on ESTCP. It supports technology demonstration validations for the priority DOD requirements. The goal is to take the best technologies that are out there and transfer those technologies into the DOD for regulatory and DOD end-user acceptance. And so why does the DOD do this? Well, we have thousands of facilities, and over the last 10 years, we've invested over $43 billion. And just in FY04, we've put over $3 billion into compliance and environmental restoration. And the key here is there's a significant portion of that budget goes toward groundwater monitoring and remediation. And this is where direct push wells enter the picture. They are commonly used throughout the DOD because they can be installed so quickly, and they have been proven to be very cost effective. And as an example, I'm the test site manager for the National Environmental Technology Test Site. That's a CERTIP-funded program, and it's called NETS, out in Port Hueneme. And we have a large MTBE plume and have installed hundreds of direct push wells for monitoring and research projects. And it's not uncommon for us to see five direct push wells going in for the same time it takes to install just one hollow stem auger well. And by the way, I'll be using that hollow stem auger and drilled well terminology interchangeably for this presentation. So the problem we have is that across the DOD, we're experiencing significant time and cost savings through the use of direct push wells, but these wells are not approved for long-term monitoring and verification sampling in most states. So the teams I'll be introducing shortly went to ESCCP with a proposal for conducting a performance comparison study between direct push and hollow stem auger installed monitoring wells. And moving on to slide 49. The key thing we're asking here in this comparison study is, do differences in direct push wells and hollow stem auger well installation methods and materials impact the groundwater analyte concentration? As I mentioned, we're doing this by siting the direct push wells either in pairs or in clusters with the hollow stem auger wells. And this particular study we did at five DOD sites, and we had 13 quarterly sampling events over a five-year period. There was a phase one and a phase two. Five events were done in phase one, and eight events were done in phase two. We also compared the spatial variability of co-located hollow stem auger wells. And in the first part of our study, we had a reference hollow stem auger well, and next to it, we compared one or several different types of direct push wells. After phase one, we reconvened our advisory committee, and it was decided that we should look at the variability also between the co-located hollow stem auger wells and the variability between some of the identical co-located direct push wells. Going to slide 50. I did just mention the advisory committee. Essentially, they were involved in every aspect of the study design. We convened them before we put one well in the ground, and we reconvened them after phase one to look at the data, look at the statistics, and then make some recommendations to go back out and run the remaining eight quarterly sampling events in the phase two. They are an expert panel from industry, universities, EPA, and Cal EPA, and most of the members are major contributors to the ASTM standards for direct push and drilled wells. The features the committee looked at when reviewing our study design included the site selection, the soil types, how do we design the well clusters. There's a variety of direct push well types and sizes. Commonly, direct push wells are from 1/2 inch to 2 inch diameter. There's also the issue of pre-packs versus no packs, as Brad had mentioned, or referred to early as the protected versus the exposed screen types. Typical drilled wells are 2 inches to 4 inches, so we wanted both these types in our studies. They reviewed the various issues with the screen lengths. Typically, in many environmental monitoring wells, you'll see 10 to 15-foot screen lengths. We had those, but we also had the shorter lengths, such as 3 and 5 feet. There are also different well installation methods were looked at. There is the popular geoprobe dynamic hammer type methods, and also the static force methods, such as SCAPS. Also, geological formations were considered. The length of the study and the minimal seasonal data collection factors were also reviewed. And then finally, the committee reviewed the data management techniques, the QAQC, and the statistical analysis method that would be employed in the study. So on to slide 51. Shown here are the ESCCP study sites. I would like to point out that most of these sites already had studies going comparing direct push and drilled wells, monitoring wells, before it was funded by ESCCP. The proposal that was put into ESCCP came from these different groups, ourselves at Port Hueneme NET site, the people out at the Air Force Research Lab, AFRL, out of Tyndall Air Force Base, and then the East Coast NETs at Dover Air Force Base, and also the Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab, CREL, and I just mentioned Louise Parker had done some, in the last question period, she had done some work on the leaching of materials out of the tips. But she also had some comparisons going up there in Hanover, New Hampshire. So these organizations came together, shared their preliminary findings, with each other and put in a proposal for a multi-year performance comparison study. Moving on to slide 52, one great attribute about the study, if you look over to column 4 of this table, the depth to groundwater, you can see at Tyndall we have 3 to 8 feet to groundwater, and up at Correll we had up to 150 feet depth of groundwater. So we had quite a range installed of well depths. And we also have a variety of contaminants as shown in the last column and a good cross-section of geological formations. We sampled over 100 monitoring wells, which provided a very good statistical base for the study also. To slide 53. Shown here is a section of 4 well clusters at the Port Rhynemi Test Cell B. And in each cluster, there's at least one drilled well and several varieties of direct push wells. The critical thing to notice here is that the depth and length of the well screen within each cluster are the same. The statistical comparisons of well types were always made within the clusters because we didn't want to introduce any variability due to well depth or screen length within a cluster. Also note the duplicate well installations. For phase two, we introduced a duplicate drilled well to determine the spatial variability between the drilled wells, as I had mentioned before. And for phase two, we also installed several duplicate direct push wells for the same reason. Both these were recommendations coming out of the phase two advisory committee meeting. Slide 54. This is some of our typical data. These results are from our East Coast NET site out at Dover Air Force Base. The data shown is for a single well pair. The data represents an average chemical concentrations over 5 quarterly sampling events in the phase one, and all comparisons on this slide and the next few slides are comparing well types, meaning we have eliminated variability due to well depth and screen lengths and have tried to minimize spatial variability by comparing within a well cluster with closely spaced monitoring wells. Taking a look at our at the rows here, the first 3 rows represent our filled parameters. The fourth and fifth row are inorganics, magnesium and chloride, and in the last row are single organic ethylbenzene. The first column represents the hollow stem auger well results, and the second column the no-pack or exposed screen direct push well results. One thing to notice on this slide are the small differences between the well types. Notice the chloride data on the fifth row. We have 18.5 ppm for the drilled well and 25.7 ppm for the direct push well. In the last row, ethylbenzene is 19.5 ppb versus 29.2 ppb. These differences are very small, and in this particular case, there are no statistically significant differences between the well types. I point this out here because the next few slides I'll be showing other data also with small differences, but that meet the criteria of being statistically significant differences. Okay, go on to slide 55. Here we have some data from one of the clusters from the Port Rhynemi Test Cell B that I showed earlier. The first 5 rows show the inorganics and turbidity, and the last row contains the organic contaminant MTBE. Now, going from left to right across the columns, column 1 is our reference 2-inch hollow stem auger well, and all the other columns are compared to this reference column. Column 2 is the 2-inch direct push well, and column 3 is the 3/4-inch direct push well. Notice the ASTM designation in the first 3 columns. These particular wells were installed rigorously to ASTM standards, meaning the soil cores were taken, the sieve analysis were performed, and the PVC screen slots and the pre-pack filters were designed in strict accordance with ASTM standards. I'm calling this out because, as everyone knows, this level of well installation detail is not performed at every site across the nation, and quite commonly, several standard slot sizes and pre-pack designs are usually employed to cover a range of soil conditions. The last 2 columns with the 3/4-inch conventional and the 3/4-inch no-pack direct push well fit into this standard approach to well installation. Okay, so let's go into the data a little bit here, and let's start with the first row. Manganese is the first column, and we see 2.21 ppm for the drilled well. Then going over to the last column, we see 2.39 ppm for the 3/4-inch no-pack direct push well, and this cell is highlighted in yellow. The yellow highlight means that the value in the cell, 2.39 ppm, has a statistically significant difference to the 2.21 ppm value in column 1. Well, you have to be asking yourself right now, how can these two values numerically so close have a significant difference? The reason is that we define a statistically significant difference as two mean values that are greater than two standard deviations apart. In this case, with manganese, it is the fact that the data variability is so low, that is, the standard deviation is very small, that we can observe significant differences in values that are numerically very tight. Further examples of relatively small differences showing up as significant difference can be seen across the rows for potassium, alkalinity, chloride, and the MTBE. Remember, we're always comparing the columns 2 through 5, which are the direct push wells, to the column 1, which is the drilled well. And now take a look at the columns 2 and 3 for chloride in the chloride row. You'll notice that both cells have the same value of 68 ppm, but one cell is highlighted is yellow highlighted and the other is not. How can this be? Well, it simply means that the data for the 2-inch direct push ASTM well, column 2, had a smaller standard deviation than the data for the 3/4-inch direct push ASTM well. One was greater than two standard deviations and from column 1, and the other was less. Another observation to note on this slide is the turbidity row. Note that the turbidity is actually higher for the drilled well, column 1, than for all the direct push wells. This is just one particular data set. On another data set, this relationship may be reversed. What is important is to detect if there are trends in the overall data sets. For ESCCP study, there were no overall trends in the turbidity data, meaning turbidity data from direct push wells were neither consistently higher or lower than turbidity data from the drilled wells. However, with the British Petroleum EPA study, which I will discuss in a few slides, we did observe a trend in the turbidity data for the NOPAC or exposed screen type monitoring wells. It was kind of a long one, but moving on to slide 56. This slide shows results for a typical well cluster at Tyndall Air Force Base. Here, the first three rows represent the inorganics and turbidity, and the rows 4 through 8 contain the organic data. Again, the yellow highlighted cells represent direct push well data's values that are two standard deviations apart from the respective values in the column 1, the 2-inch drilled well. A particular note here is the 1.5-inch NOPAC direct push well in column 2. As shown, the mean organic chemical values are significantly higher for this direct push well than the 2-inch drilled well. So does this mean that 1.5-inch direct push wells yield higher organic chemical concentration than 2-inch drilled wells? Well, the answer to that is no, because, again, there was no trend in the overall data set that indicates this. It must be remembered that spatial heterogeneity, as Brad talked about quite a bit there, cannot be removed in actual field comparisons of monitoring wells. It's quite possible in this particular example that the 1.5-inch direct push well was exposed to a preferential flow path containing higher contaminant concentrations, even though the drilled well and the direct push wells were sited less than 2 feet apart. Looking at the big picture, it must be realized that in a data set with over 50,000 data points derived from low and high variability environmental groundwater samples, there is no way there will not be some significant differences occurring in the data set. The key is to observe if there are trends in the data. And are direct push wells always higher or lower where significant difference exists? What we found over our 5-year study was that there were no trends in the organic or inorganic data, and that the data quality from the samples collected from the direct push and the drilled monitoring wells were comparable. On to slide 57. This slide is a quick summary of the data set we managed and performed analyses on. As I mentioned, there were over 100 monitoring wells involved in the study. The data set included 14 organic contaminants, 12 inorganic chemicals, and 7 water quality and field parameters. There were over 50,000 analytical data values, as I mentioned, and these were collected over 13 sampling events. To analyze this data, we used the analysis of variance methods, commonly referred to as ANOVA, to compare differences in well locations, well depths, screen lengths, temporal changes, and most importantly, the well types. Going to slide 58. So to conclude the ESCCP study, I would like to point out that the statistical analyses indicate that direct push wells compare favorably to hollow stem auger installed wells. Where we did see statistically significant differences between the well types, the magnitude of those differences were generally low. We saw no trend in the differences favoring either well type, and management decisions to use a direct push well would not be impacted. The analysis of variance did reveal large statistical differences due to temporal and well depth parameters, but not due to well types. Generally, we found very low variability in the inorganic data and very high variability in some of the organic data. The high variability of some of the organic contaminants may be due in part to individual chemical soil absorption properties causing increased heterogeneity in the groundwater. And finally, in phase one, we performed a significant amount of triplicate sampling that showed very repeatable field and lab techniques. And based on this, the advisory committee agreed that the standard QC methods could be resumed for our phase two part of the study. So this concludes the ESCTP part of the presentation. And now we're going to move on to slide 59. And here I'd like to present some of the results from the British Petroleum and EPA Region 4 and 5 well comparison study. As with the ESCTP study, the question we ask here again is, do differences in direct push and drilled well insulation methods and materials impact groundwater analyte concentrations? In this study, there were four fuel station sites impacted with dissolved phase hydrocarbons, and two of the sites were located in Ohio, and two of the other sites were located in Georgia. Going on to slide 60. This slide provides the an overview of the BP EPA study design features. This study had a total of 24 monitoring wells. The comparison provided 12 pairs of co-located direct push and drilled wells installed approximately 2.5 feet apart. All the direct push wells were 1 inch in diameter, and the drilled wells were either 2 inch or 4 inch in diameter. An important feature of the study that differed from the ESCTP study was that all the direct push wells were the exposed screen types, having no filter packs or annular space seals. The direct push wells screen intervals varied from 10 to 15 feet, and just like the ESCTP study, the screen lengths and depths were kept exactly matched within the well pairs. This study consisted of a total of 4 quarterly sampling events. Over all the sites, there were 8 analytes and 9 additional geochemistry parameters evaluated, including dissolved oxygen, CO2, ferrous iron, nitrate, methane, alkalinity, and sulfate. In all, there were about a total of 768 analytical data values were collected. Also, like the ESCTP study, analysis of variance, the ANOVA statistical methods were used. Moving on to slide 61, provided here is a summary table of the site characteristics of the 4 study sites. A key feature of this study was that some of the sites had lower permeability clay-type silt-type soils. This was a nice addition to the ESCTP study that generally tested in higher permeability soils. The depth of groundwater was generally shallow and comparable to many of our DOD sites, especially in the Navy. With the added variety of testing teams, test parameters, geographical settings, and soil formations, we felt the ESCTP and the BP-EPA, that's a mouthful, huh, studies were very complementary efforts. Going on to slide 62, this slide provides the results of the ANOVA statistical analysis for the BP-EPA study. For MTBE, they found no significant differences at the 4 sites. For BTEX, there were no significant differences at 3 of the sites, and the direct push wells were significantly higher at just 1 of the sites. Naphthalene had a slightly higher concentration for the direct push wells, but this did not occur across all sites, and there were no significant differences for any of the geochemical parameters. A key observation of this study was that the mean hydraulic conductivity was over 4 times greater than the direct push wells, and that was in addition, that at the 4 sites, the turbidity was consistently higher in the direct push wells. Since none of the direct push wells in this study had a filter pack, the conclusion could be reached that the absence of a filter pack was the reason for the higher turbidity. However, well development was also a factor. All wells were initially developed with standard well pumping methods, and after the study was completed, the direct push wells were redeveloped using surge block methods. After this, there was no difference in direct push and drilled well turbidity levels. Unfortunately, the resources were not available to retest for hydraulic conductivity after the surge block development, but it can be hypothesized that the redevelop might have some impact on it. It was also found that water levels for direct push well and drilled wells were nearly identical for the study. Going on to slide 63, conclusions for the BP EPA study. The statistics indicate that direct push wells compare favorably to drilled wells. Where differences did exist, the direct push well results were usually higher. An obvious recommendation coming out of the study is to use surge block well development techniques for developing exposed screen type direct push wells to reduce the turbidity. Also, hydraulic conductivity values within an order of magnitude are generally considered acceptable, and so direct push values that are only four times that of drilled values would probably not affect management decisions. Okay, now we're going to move on to some other technologies. In slide 64, and these next few slides, I will introduce some of the characterization technologies that are made possible through the use of direct push wells, the fact that you're pushing a well instead of drilling a well. And first one up here is a new technology is the GeoVis, and we use this to determine, get an estimate of porosity in the soil. If we look here with the shown here in the slide is the GeoVis sensor probe that's integrated into a conventional direct push rig. There's an LED light source that projects into the soil continuously as it is being lowered down, or it can be done at static selected depths. The light is reflected off the soil matrix and back into the probe there, which is recorded on a color video camera, and those video images then are fed back to the computer at the surface. Now, going to slide 65, we see the typical images that come out of the GeoVis. And starting up on the upper left, we see the color image here, and that color image is put through a high-pass filter to get better resolution and contrast. And then a gray threshold is set. And as you can see in the third one over on the right side here, now we have a black and white image. And the black here represents the pore space, and the white represents the soil. And so what it's done, we go one more down to the bottom left here, and we see that we're counting the pixels here. And from this, we can actually calculate the porosity. And this can be done, as I mentioned, as a probe is being pushed into the soil or in a static sense. Now, going on to slide 66, we see a single one where the pixels have been counted, and a porosity of 29% has been estimated. And again, the black represents the pore space, and the white represents the soil. So this is one neat technology that's just coming out. Going to slide 67, we have another one here, the high-resolution piezocone, which has been around for a bit now. And this essentially is a direct-push sensor probe that converts pore pressure to water level or hydraulic head. And those head values can actually get accurate within plus or minus of about an inch. And very importantly, they can also the piezocone can also measure vertical gradients, hydraulic gradients. And to give an example, out here we have a biobarrier out here at our site in Port Hueneme, where we actually saw a vertical gradient that actually pushed our MTBE plume about 80% of it down to about the lower third of our aquifer, just above our aquitard. So having this information about vertical gradients can make a big difference in where you actually put your treatment system. And another thing about the high-resolution piezocone is that you can actually make estimates and simultaneously collect soil type and make estimates of hydraulic conductivity. Now, going on to slide 68, we actually are showing the high-resolution piezocone here. And there are load cells inside the probe that measure both the skin friction along the body and also the force that it takes to push the tip through the soil. And if you look at the brown ring here, that ring is permeable, and it enables there's a pressure reducer inside that allows us to take pore pressure measurements as it's lowered down. And the results here are real-time soil classification and water level determination. Now, if we go over to slide 69, we actually see one of the dissipation curves from lowering it down here. The final pressure that we see this dissipation curve here, and that final pressure that it finally comes to is what corresponds to the head at a given location and depth. And so what we have here is we can take this dissipation data I missed one thing. The actual rate of that curve is actually the rate of the dissipation, and it's a function of the hydraulic conductivity. And so with that piezocone pressure transducer, we can actually get this dissipation data, and we take that dissipation data and we add it to the piezocone load cell results, which gives us soil type. With those two, dissipation data and soil type, we can actually start making estimates of, in real time, of the hydraulic conductivity K. So moving on to slide 70, here we have where we can see where there's multiple head values are taken in a particular push. Now those blue marks are actually that you see on the red line there are actually stops where the pressure was measured during the push. And if you extrapolate back, actually draw a line through those blue dots, you come back and you actually get an estimate of the water table depth. And as I mentioned before, we can get that within about a plus or a minus an inch. And note the straight line through the blue marks, and this indicates a more homogeneous type of soil matrix. Now, if clay lens and other heterogeneous type soil matrix conditions are actually existing, they can be identified with these pressure head measurements because these blue lines no longer line up, and that's an indication of a vertical gradient. And now we move on to slide 71. This is a typical bore log using the piezo cone. On the vertical axis here, we have the actually the depth below the top of the water table, and going now on the horizontal axis in the first column here, what we see are measurements in real time of the pore pressure, and that's done with, as I mentioned, with the piezo cone pressure transducer. In the second column here, we see actual soil classification real time estimates, and that's done with the piezo load piezo cone load cells. And then with these two again, we can estimate the hydraulic conductivity K that's in the third column here. And then over on the upper right there, we see the pore pressure hydrostatic pressure diagram that I showed before, and also the pore pressure dissipation there on the lower right. And now going to slide 72, we have the well design software, and this is some real neat software that's been developed that you can actually design the sand pack and the PVC slot size actually right out in the field. And so, again, if we look at the vertical here, that's the depth below the groundwater table. And in this first column here, we have a fluorescence probe is put on this particular probe here. And so you could measure, as you're lowering down, something like PAHs. And so you'd actually see where the contamination is in the vertical strata there. And then the second column is the soil classification that's measured with the load cell. And then we can actually, with this information, we can actually, in real time, with this software, design the sand pack and the grain size distribution and all that, and the slot size on the PVC pipe according to ASTM standards. And so we have a situation here where we can actually go out in the field and measure, not only get all this information about what we have, what kind of soil type we have and hydraulic conductivity we have, but we can actually design that sand pack and slot size in real time and actually put it to where in the zones where we actually see the contamination. So some really neat technology is coming out for the with the direct push rig. So moving on to slide 73, I'd like to summarize my talk here. In the DOD, we see hundreds of millions of potential savings from extended use of DP wells. The studies I presented cover a wide range of inorganic and organic contaminants, soil types, well depths, well types, and geographical locations. For the ESCP study, we completed a five-year well comparison study in which the results of statistical analysis applied to over 50,000 analytical data values convinces us that the data quality from DP wells is comparable to the drilled wells. Also, an independent study by BP and EPA Region 4 and 5 supports this data quality issue. Data variance, or the standard deviation, for inorganics and highly soluble organics is very low, as we saw in our study, and data variance is usually high for the organics with lower solubility and that tend to absorb the soil particles more. As would be expected with a very large database, there are numerous instances of statistically significant differences between DP and drilled wells, but most importantly, there are no trends in these differences. And finally, by the fact that DP wells are pushed into the ground instead of drilled, a large suite of new technologies are emerging that allow us to make many real-time estimates of soil porosity, the soil classifications, and 3D groundwater flow, including that vertical gradient I was just discussing. This, in turn, allows real-time, well-designed plume delineation and remedial system implementation. So that concludes my part of the talk, and now I'd like to reintroduce Keisha Long to discuss the state case studies and then provide our presentation wrap-up. Keisha?
All right, thank you. We are on slide 74, and we're going to start with Delaware, and I want to point out that Delaware is a barrier state, as I mentioned the map of the United States earlier, But Delaware has used DP technology at CERCLA sites, brownfield sites, voluntary cleanup, UST, and solid waste sites. And DP wells are used during site inspections, removal assessments, and remedial investigations. The contaminants they've investigated include chlorinated solvents, petroleum constituents, metals, and methane gas. Delaware has installed permanent 1 to 2 inch diameter DP wells with pre-packed filters, and the pre-packed filters they found eliminated the problems they were having previously with turbidity and the consequential false positive sampling results for metals. Some problems they did encounter include the hole collapsing during the installation of the DP filter pack and the shattering of casings. However, the pre-packed wells showed representative samples and a cost savings to the state of Delaware of 50 to 60% when compared to conventional wells. Next slide is the state of Missouri. And they have used DP technology at multiple CERCLA sites, petroleum storage tank sites, and landfills. The contaminants of concern included volatile organics and methane gas. In the state of Missouri, they conducted an extensive comparative study, which they started in 1994. And the direct push wells were installed side by side with conventionally drilled wells at multiple landfill sites. Analysis of the data generated during the comparative study indicated that the DP wells could be installed at an average savings of about 69% over conventionally drilled 2-inch monitoring wells. And the speaker's notes offer the link to the online report, and I believe it's also linked at the end with the rest of the feedback links. Okay, let's go on to the next slide. The state of South Carolina. We have installed DP wells at Superfund, RECRA, UST, Dry Cleaner, Brownfield, and other sites. And we have looked for contaminants of concern, including volatile and semi-volatile organics and inorganics. The Dry Cleaner Restoration Trust Fund in the state has a sampling protocol that involves the use of DP technologies, and the DP wells are used to help us to determine the vertical and horizontal extent of primarily PCE plumes that are typically found at dry cleaners. Infilled colorimetric tubes are used for on-site analysis. For example, at one dry cleaner in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, the combination of DP wells and real-time analysis led to the determination of the extent of a large PCE plume in about 2 months. And this plume was located or is located in a heavily commercial and residential area. This project also required a lot of contact with property owners and access issues. The next slide, the state of Wisconsin, slide 77. Wisconsin has installed DP wells at their agricultural chemical cleanup program sites, multiple Superfund sites, at petroleum storage tank investigations, and for research on wetlands and groundwater surface water interaction. The contaminants of concern range from pesticides to volatile organics. The Wisconsin Administrative Code specifies standards for the design, installation, construction, abandonment, and documentation of groundwater wells. The DP technology has commonly been used on the agricultural sites for the collection of grab groundwater samples and for installing temporary monitoring wells. And recently, they have seen the use of this technology for the installing permanent monitoring wells. Wisconsin says where used in the past, DP wells have been very cost effective when compared to conventional drilling methods. Okay, the next slide is 78, the state of Washington, just briefly, they've used DP wells as a standard practice. One innovation we came across when we interviewed some people out of Washington State, one innovation being tested is the attaching of a laser head to the DP rig to break up cobbles. So they're attempting to make one of the disadvantages into no problem. Okay, let's go to the next slide, 79, some stakeholder concerns. Environmental regulators need to communicate early and often with stakeholders so participants can gain a greater understanding of the regulatory process, the technologies used, and remediation techniques. In my personal experience, the community seems to like the DP technology because of the they create less mess, are less destructive to lawns, and are not a major disruption. Also, a DP loaded on a pickup truck is a lot less noticeable than a large drill rig and its necessary support truck. The hammering noise from the dynamic DP rigs can be a disruption, but this is just a temporary inconvenience. Next slide, sensitive location, slide 80. DP well rigs can get in and out of sensitive locations quickly. Also, the small diameter of the drilled hole, the reduced time spent on property, and the minimal waste generated helps with the landowner relations and the environment. Okay, we're almost finished. Next slide, health and safety, slide 81. This is just a table listing various health and safety concerns associated with all types of drilling. Just real quickly, some safety issues include hidden obstacles and utilities, flying debris, head injury, feet becoming trapped under the probe foot or derrick, hands becoming trapped in the equipment, and exposure to hazardous substances. And some remedies include requesting and locating your utilities prior to work, wearing the appropriate PPE, and being aware of your surroundings while using the equipment. Just again, of course, you should have an appropriate health and safety plan before going into the field. Slide 82, so conclusions. DP well installations result in less IDW, less exposure to contaminants, saves money, and provides representative data. Also, continuing slide 82, DP wells can be installed quickly, and they minimally disturb the environment. Landowners also more readily accept the installation of a DP well when compared with hollow stem auger wells. The next slide, some things to consider on slide 84. DP installations can be limited by consolidated materials, and many state regulations restrict the use of DP wells for long-term use. Also, if it's necessary to install a well using a casing greater than 2 inches in diameter, then the conventional drilling equipment should be used. But the bottom line, the next slide, 85, various studies, as presented earlier by Bill Major, have found little difference between paired DP and conventionally drilled wells for the analytes investigated. And DP wells provide an efficient means to define the vertical and lateral extent of groundwater contamination. So, slide 86, thank you for participating, and I'll hand it over to Juliana for the second question and answer session.
Thank you, Keisha. We do now have time for questions, but we are going to go ahead and go to the links page first. For our simulcast participants, if you'd like, you can go ahead and use that question mark button at the top of the screen to start sending in questions. For the links to additional resources, please select that area of the slide, and that's going to take you over to the links page. And we do list the URL on the slide because this is a resource that's going to continue to be available for you. The first thing on the links page that I'd like to point out is how to get to the feedback form. If you look to the left Under the Clue In Sun, the third button down is feedback. And we do appreciate if everyone on the call today provide feedback. We use that information as we continue to develop classes and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to provide your feedback. Looking to the right, on the links to additional resources, the first item under Section 1, Download Today's ITRC Training, will allow you to download the PowerPoint presentation that we've seen during today's training class. In addition to what we've seen on the slides, more information is available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. The next item, the use of direct push well technology for long-term environmental monitoring in groundwater investigations, the SCM-2 document, is the document that was the basis for today's training class. And we do encourage you to look at this document. From this link, you can go over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of the document. That same page will allow you to download the other documents from the ITRC sampling, characterization, and monitoring team. In Section 2, we have some documents and websites that you may find useful as you continue to look into this subject area. And then scrolling down, you can see we also link over to the ITRC website in Section 3 and to CLUIN in Section 4. We do now want to take time for questions from our audience. For our phone line audience, please remember to unmute your phone, and that's *7 to unmute. For our simulcast participants, you can send in a question using that orange question mark button that you saw at the top of the slides. When you send in your question, please include, for our phone line, when you ask your question, please include your name and location. Do we have questions from the phone line to start? From our simulcast audience, Kenneth Davis at the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality in Austin, have there been any side-by-side studies comparing conventional well to DP wells with regards to the measurement of NAPL levels? If so, what was learned?
Well, I'm not aware of any studies of that type. Keisha or Bill?
No, I don't know of any.
Just in thinking about the question, I wouldn't expect that there would be any reason for there to be a difference, because the physical characteristics of both types of wells are so similar that but I'm not aware of any study that's looked into it.
Yeah, it would be kind of a specialty item.
From Bob Martin at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management in Indianapolis, any data on longevity such as collapse, siltation, clogging, or fouling?
Well, I mean, we've had our wells in Wainemi have been in for a while, and Corral, and at Dover. I mean, we're getting at least 10-year data at this point, where we're not experiencing anything worse than with drilled wells at this point, but maybe not 20 years out at this point. Brad, how about you?
I don't think we have anything more than about 5 years, but no, we haven't observed any tendency for there to be any particular problems associated with direct push installed wells that would be any different than a conventional well.
From Sarah Libeau at Environ in Arlington, Virginia, during installation of the half-inch diameter and one-inch diameter DP wells, was the same size tooling, drill rod, utilized for both, i.e., were the boreholes the same diameter? And were the thicknesses of the sand pre-pack the same?
Just to clarify, it's actually... I suppose you could use 1/2 inch. I have never used that. The smallest I've used is 3/4 inch. And the answer is that yes, we do, when using the protected screen installation technique, the driller will normally use an appropriately sized drive casing for the particular well casing that you have stipulated, because it takes more effort. You know, you wouldn't want to use the largest size drive casing if you're using a smaller size well casing, because it's more difficult to push that into the subsurface. And then as far as the filter packs and the pre-packs, my experience is that they're all the same thickness. Bill or Keisha, Have you had any differing experiences with that?
Yeah, but that's our experience too. That they were, you know, fairly standardized. The ones that, you know, that you can purchase and or that were actually made on site or something like that. Because there's a certain, you know, there's just a certain size you have to fit it within the drive rod, and you can't go larger than that.
Yes.
So you're trying to get as good a seal and everything as you can. So.
From Diane Douglas with Washington, D.C., how would you quantify the impact of compaction on formation material by the driving action of DP technology?
Well, this is always the great question, and with DP rigs, you know, there should be a separate study that studies this, and it was actually before we took on our ESCCP project, we you know, there's one or two routes you can go. You can say we're going to say how do they perform as far as measuring inorganics and inorganic chemicals, and is there any difference between them? Or the other thing is that you could go, how do you actually change the formation? And so the discussion goes over and over whether, you know, with the DP rig, when you push down, you're actually, you know, as a person just asked the question, you're actually taking material and compacting it into the side walls of the hole that you're making. But then the other, there's another factor with drilling wells. You have something actually spinning several times and doing its own form of compaction. When you drill something, it doesn't just, you know, drill and just keep moving down. It actually keeps going over the same spot as it goes down also. So there's two forms of things that could actually affect hydraulic conductivity. And whether one is worse than the other is, I haven't seen a comprehensive study on that, but it would be a great study to do.
You may have just addressed my next question from Sean Haggerty at the Pennsylvania DEP in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Is there a quantifiable amount of cross-contamination one could expect with DP wells, and is that due to the slug of displacement? Do you want to add anything to address his question specifically?
Brad, do you think that question is, and Keisha, do you think that's a question of what Brad mentioned as far as taking contamination downward? Is that what that question's about, or is it?
Yeah, that would be my interpretation of that question.
Okay, thank you.
So then the answer again is that, you know, if you are faced with a situation where you do have contamination in the overlying soil, then you would probably want to be using the protected screen insulation technique. And, you know, as long as you're using proper development techniques, then I wouldn't be overly concerned about dragging contamination downwards.
From Ryan Turner at Sandtech in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I routinely encounter observation wells that are poorly developed. Do you prefer the use of surge blocks when developing wells?
Well, I tell you, as I mentioned in my talk, and then if we saw with Gary Robbins out here in Port Hueneme, you can do a much, much better job with the surge block. And Gary Robbins has probably developed more wells than anybody. I mean, hundreds and thousands, you know, that he's done it. And he swears by the surge block method. For even wells that were developed with other means, I've experienced him actually coming out and cleaning up that well with the surge block method. And then, of course, there's the BP-EPA study I mentioned that they couldn't get the turbidity out of there until they did surge block. So. And certainly for the exposed screen type might be more necessary. And then just certain formations. Everybody knows that some formations you don't get that much turbidity, but in other ones you get tons of it. And so it may just be a matter of, you know, you see how it develops and then see if you need to take it to the level of the surge block method.
For other simulcast questions that were submitted earlier, I think we may have addressed those in the second half. So if we did not, or if you have a slightly different question, please, if I have not addressed your simulcast question, please send in another question. Do we have any questions from our from our phone line audience?
Yes.
Yes, what is your question?
I have a question. The name is Maureen Esterbrook, and I'm in New Hampshire. And often we encounter very dense glacial tills or many sites with cobbles. And I was wondering if you could describe how the laser cone, the laser head cones work and how effective they are to break up cobbles.
Yes, this is Keisha. One of our team members interviewed the guy who was developing it, and I believe it's still in the introductory stages. So I will have to get back to you to give you a better description of how it works, what level they're at now with the development.
And aren't they developing some different tips now with the standard probe that can break apart some of this stuff too?
Would you look up
for a further follow-up, please?
Find what we did for the last.
I'm sorry. Please check to be sure that your phone is on mute if you're speaking now. For the person who just asked that question, please follow up with the instructor directly. Their email address is on slide 6. Or if you'd like, you can send the email to the training program, and I will pass that on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any metals testing?
We don't have any more questions from our simulcast audience, so I am going to go ahead and wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. We do use that information and would appreciate you taking a few minutes to provide feedback. For more information about ITRC, including information on projects for 2009, please visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again and have a great day.